Don't. Submitted by Anonymous.
Hi, Edie and Nick. Hopefully you could help me figure out what entity, guardian angel, maybe demon, maybe a ghost, that interfered the moment that I was going to be caught stealing. Let me explain. I grew up in a small town in Connecticut. When I was a freshman in high school, I had no regard of consequences, especially consequences that could come along from stealing. My best friend Jamie and I would get what we needed by shoplifting. Chips, clothes, if we got more cocky, perfume, and speakers. For several weeks, I eyed a cute shirt and jeans that I planned to steal for picture day. So 3 days before picture day, on a Sunday afternoon, I had my backpack all set and my usual covered disguise, a baseball hat. Now, I've done the same routine to prepare for my big caper. Walk around the store, spot any workers, and find a corner with no cameras. And everything seemed to be going well. But for the first time ever, my hands were sweaty. My heart was racing. I wasn't sure what was happening to me. I shook it off. Jamie used to call these moments, moments of remorse. But this time it wasn't. It was more doubt and fear. Either way, it was now or don't have a cute outfit for picture day. I grabbed what I wanted, walked to the corner that I picked out, slowly pulled my backpack in front of me, and began unzipping to complete my fashion crime. The zipper, as always, gets stuck halfway. Due to me squeezing in the clothes, and also headphones I decided to add. My back was turned away from the cameras. Then I feel three taps on my shoulder. I stopped automatically. My heart froze. I turn around expecting to face security or worker, but absolutely no one was there. My sweaty hands drop my backpack on the floor. I begin to scurry, trying to gather myself and my thoughts on what just happened. I start hearing voices getting closer to the aisle I was in. It was security. Their radios beat loud and clear. I knew I couldn't play it off with my backpack half open, stuff sticking out. I decided to hide behind huge furniture boxes on the shelf. I hear security footsteps come closer. I peek out. I see two guys looking around my aisle, then going ahead to the next one. I was holding my breath and waiting a few minutes until it was safe to continue. Now, the taps were good enough to scare me, but my greed and desire to have a cute outfit got the best of me. Hearing no one, I finally zipped up my backpack. I ended up putting the headphones in my pocket. As I was squeezing out from behind the furniture boxes to leave, I hear someone whisper, "Don't," in my right ear. I stopped mid-squeeze. I looked back. Nothing but a wall behind me. I called it quits on my life of crime. While leaving the store, I yanked open my backpack and poured everything out. To this day, I don't know what happened. But whatever it was sure humbled me. Never have I stole again. Nowadays, I catch teenagers stealing, but I do them the favor, or whatever, that was done for me. I walk past them and say, "Don't."
Welcome to the True Scary Stories with Edie and Nick podcast. This is a podcast where two comedians read scary stories submitted to us by our fans and stuff we find on all corners of the internet. This podcast does have commentary after every story, so if you're not into that, check out our Just the Terror episodes that are located right here where you're listening to True Scary Stories with Edie and Nick. You can send your scary story to us on our Facebook group, Instagram, or website, all at True Scary Stories with Edie.
There you go, which is how we got this story.
Nice.
Website.
Thank you so much for submitting this story. I think that you're very brave. After a ghost tells you not to, you still keep going. You were really a fashionista. I'd love to know what kind of outfit it was.
Yeah.
It was a, you know, picture day. I remember those days. Especially went to a uniform school.
Yeah.
Picture day where you get to wear free dress was very important.
Yeah.
I remember one day I came and I had mustard on my shirt. And everyone was like, "What is that? What is that? Is that a stain?" I'm like, "Man, I wish I would have stolen something."
Oh, man.
No, I was way too young for that.
Dang.
But I can't believe the want for that outfit was that strong. Even though they caught her, she was still going to try.
Well, the ghost caught her. She was in it. So it must have been the ghost.
I thought there were real people looking for her, though.
The security was.
Yeah, that's what I mean. She knows that they know.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like she's probably not getting out of the store.
Yeah.
The best thing to do would be to leave the stuff. And then walk out, and when they stop you, act all mad, like, "What?"
Oh, man.
And make them look like the jerks.
Yeah. I mean, look, you shouldn't have added the headphones, especially since you know that you have a faulty backpack, okay? It's not part of the outfit. You got cocky, right? I think what tapped you on the shoulder was not a demon or a guardian angel, but I do think it was a ghost. And I think it was a ghost of a shoplifter that also held their breath behind those furniture boxes, except they really held their breath and then just died.
Some say if you listen, you can still hear them taking a pair of old headphones.
Yeah, they were like, that's my headphone.
That's my headphone I wanted.
Dude.
I think it's probably more than likely just one of your family members, some kind of relative that you've lost who didn't want to see you get in trouble. Mine didn't care. I got in trouble when I would do stuff like that. Mine were like, let her have it.
Or it was, you remember that King of the Hill episode where
it's not King of the Hill.
Was haunted by that bassoon player? No. I forget the guy's name. Yeah, and he was hiding in there, and they were trying to trap him. That's who it was.
He's supposed to be like Yakov.
Yeah.
It's like based on that character. All right, let's keep going. All right, for my segment, it's actually a lot similar to our story. It's about scary warnings.
Whoa.
Heated warnings that should be listened to.
Heated?
Heed this warning?
Yeah, that's why.
Not heated. Not like a heated blanket.
But that's what listen to means.
Okay.
Or heed means listen.
Okay, that's what I meant. Heated.
Yes.
Jeez, Nick. Okay.
Okay.
This first story comes from Diamond Dog Day, and it goes like this. In 2015, I had just started a business with my brother, flipping houses. He had been on a road trip with his daughter for over 1 week, and I'd just gotten back home. I spoke with him on the phone, and he said that he would be back down to meet me at the property that we had just remodeled that Friday to finish it up and get it listed. When I hung up the phone, I was walking up to the kitchen when I thought to myself, he isn't coming back tomorrow. I have been scolded in the past for being too negative. And so I just keep telling myself and try to put it out of my mind. The following day, I was sitting on the edge of my bed when the phone rang. I looked at the caller ID and it was my mother. I immediately knew what the phone call was going to be about. I picked up the phone and my mother said that my brother had just passed away from a heart attack and they were trying to revive him. She said that she would call me back and I knew without a shadow of a doubt he was already gone. I walked to the kitchen and stood in a daze. I looked at the wall where the afternoon sun was casting a bright spot and found myself staring at it. It seemed brighter and wider in an instant and surrounded me and was holding me. I wasn't scared. I just stood there, letting the light envelop me. Just as quickly as it happened, it was gone, and I was brought back to reality, and the sound of my phone ringing was when I realized that he had taken his last breath, and I answered it. It was my mother saying that he had just died. To this day, I cannot explain it.
Whoa.
Right.
Okay,
Jico, go ahead. Say something
well,
about
what
it.
What was the warning? The heated warning.
The heated warning was that she knew he was going to die.
Oh.
She got the feeling. She said, I know he's not coming back.
Oh, okay. So be prepared.
Or warn him.
The warning was.
Or warn him, hey, go to the hospital right now.
Yeah.
That could be the warning.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good. What else do you think about this, Nick?
Oh, man. I mean, you know. That's the thing about these warnings.
They're
heated.
They're so annoying.
I don't know what to say. It's scary. I don't know.
Okay. Well, Nick, if you loved that one, I forgot that there are a few people who read this and had a similar experience.
Oh, no.
Flipstance says, for many years, I had the same feeling that my brother wouldn't survive childhood. I can actively remember ruminating about how he might die. I would think about the future and have this feeling that he was not going to be there. It was so strong of a feeling that, like, I was expecting it to happen at any time. When he was 16, he went hiking and was bitten by a tick. He fell ill and dropped in a coma for a week. It took about 3 weeks for him to get back to normal, but I realized soon after that the feeling that he was going to die had completely evaporated.
So he did live. Yeah.
And then the brother got rid of the feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I have this... Oh, you want to read the next
one?
No,
go for it.
I have this strong feeling, and this is what I've been trying to tell people, all right? Look, You need to stop focusing on negative feelings, especially when it is towards somebody else, because you are speaking it to the universe and it's going to happen. Just stop. When you think these things, stop thinking it. Stop putting it out
there.
They
can't.
They have to. You have to stop.
Nick, you're saying to not heed the warning.
I'm saying don't speak the universe. When people tell me things like, you know, when people say things like, oh, just wait, one day you'll have a kid. It's like, don't say that. Because then I'm going to wake up pregnant. Me, somehow.
I thought this story was, I thought the guy was going to say, I always knew he was going to die. So I just killed him instead.
Yeah, me too. Like, it's like, no. And then so you were the one that set up the camping trip in a very heavily ticked area. I bet you know, it's like, I knew it. He was going to.
He was like, here's the list. Brother, hiking trip, ticks, tick.
Yeah.
Tick. Tick,
and then
tick.
He didn't die. And Whoa. Then I didn't have that feeling no more.
This person says, some people in my family have had simultaneous visitations at the moment of a family member's death.
Okay.
Most in no way are superstitious or religious. So that would mean when all of their family, it was like they would be like on a Zoom call. Like when the person in their family would die, they would get visited. Like
yeah.
a Zoom call.
I mean, I've heard stuff like that. Yeah, we've read things like that.
Okay, so now I'm done with the heated warnings. Do you have anything else to say about the heated warnings?
All I'm saying, guys, okay?
Be
aware. This is my heated warning. Okay. Be aware of the energy that you speak into the universe, the thoughts that you allow to fester and grow into a reality. Okay? Be aware of that.
Yeah.
Stop doing it.
It's hard, though, because sometimes you can't get them out of your mind. Like, have you ever been, like, praying or something, and then when you're praying, you're like, I hate God, or something like that. You're like, no, wait, don't say that.
Yeah, your mind messes with you. God's
like,
not real. Whoa.
You're like, don't think that mind. Yeah.
Worship Batman. Worship Batman. Batman.
That's not really what I think.
Oh, yeah. No, your mind will mess with you. And I think, you know, we've talked about that. People that go kind of like crazy with their thoughts, I think they forget that, yeah, we all, almost all of us have that inner monologue. You know, you're not supposed to fall for it. It's just you messing with yourself.
Okay, let's keep going. All right, this one really tripped me out. So this is from Babby Bo. When my brother was about 7 years old, he woke up one day acting really strange and didn't get out of bed. My mother went to go check on him, and he started sobbing. It was awful, and he sounded like he was so full of despair. It wasn't the cry of a 7-year-old. My mother kept asking, "What's wrong? You can tell me." And after a few long minutes, he finally confided in her. He told her that he had been living with the same day over and over and over again, and that it was always the same every time. But that's not what upset him. What made him cry was today was the first day in a really long time where something had changed. We never spoke about it again. He was seemingly fine for a few days, but I still have no idea what happened. I know my brother, and it's not something he would have made up out of the blue. Completely unexplainable from my perspective.
Wow, that's scary.
I know, that's the one where I was reading it, and I went, ooh.
No.
Because it's like, I thought it was going to be something like, and every day at the end of this day, our mom passes away or something like that. So he just keeps having to relive it.
Oh.
But the reason he was freaking out was because today was finally something different. Like he got out of the loop.
Yeah. I thought maybe he was going to be like, I'm an old man trapped in a 7-year-old body. That's what I thought. And he was just realizing it. No, yeah. I'm an old soul. I'm not supposed to be here.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, reliving the same day. I have those moments where, you know, that is very scary. You know, I wonder, because you don't want to get stuck in that loop.
Yeah, and there's no one that you could really talk to about it, because it's like every day you could talk to them about it, and it's just going to be the same thing. And to hear that, I just instantly believe him, because I'd be like, what? That's so scary. I believe you.
Yeah. Especially if he was really like freaking out about it.
As a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah, as a kid.
Oh, man, it's terrible.
Like, this could all be a plot, though, to get him to stay home from school. He's like, I love this day. And they're like, man, let him have something different. Like, let's go to Disneyland.
Yeah, let's go.
Okay, that'll be different.
Oh, I'm reliving this day.
It's either the scariest story ever, or it's just a really genius plan.
Well, I mean, all he had to do was watch Groundhog Day and be like, I'm going to do that.
But I really think it's true. I think he was.
Yeah, it's wild.
I'm happy. I hope that he's out of it, and It seemed like he broke three. I wonder what the thing was that was different.
I know. I wonder what
that
was
different. That would have been an important part of the story.
Yeah. He needs to really get on his seven-year-old brother's case and find this out.
Okay. I'm going to read one more while we're at
it. Oh, he's great.
Okay, good.
Wait a minute. Didn't we just read this story?
Okay. No, actually, kind of scared me a little bit. All right. This is written by Night Times. It's pretty short. My mother told me that when she was pregnant with my brother, she used to go get crazy nightmares and stuff and see shadow figures that kept harassing her 2 to 3 times a week, claiming that they are coming for him. She never understood what it meant. Well, I understand what that means. They're coming for him.
Oh, okay.
She never understood what that meant until she gave birth to my brother, but he was 8 weeks premature. He unfortunately didn't make it. Parents had to make the decision to pull the plug and let him pass away peacefully. 2 days after that whole ordeal, she had the same nightmare, but instead they were taunting her, saying, "We got him. He's ours now." And never had a single one of those nightmares ever again. That was 20 years ago.
That's scary.
That is really scary.
Yeah. Okay. So we can pontificate and think, all right, was this an entity that was after this kid? Or, like I said before, was she putting it in her head constantly, stressing her body out, weakening the baby?
No, because she stopped having it. That was the last dream where they said, "We got him." And that was it. They got him.
Okay. Well.
It's really awful.
It's very awful.
It's weird on the show, and the stories are actually scary.
Yeah.
Because you're like, well, there's nothing really funny about that, is there?
Well, I also say you should not hyper-focus on negative thoughts.
Yeah. I was reading, though, when you have negative thoughts, they usually don't manifest into things. Like, if you're scared of that.
Yeah, usually.
But that might be something people just say to make you get out of the loop of negative thoughts.
And there's also no way we can have a study to figure out the actual percentage of negative thoughts that have come to fruition. You know, that would be a too large of a study. And no pharmaceutical company or college administration would fund.
Actually, a girl on TikTok that said that.
Oh, okay.
Scientists. Oh,
okay.
We know just some girl on TikTok. I don't even follow her, but she sounded smart.
She sounded smart. Hey, guys, I got 15 seconds to tell you. Don't think things, things, don't think them. Okay. TikTok dance time.
Follow me for more.
For more thinking.
All right. This last heated warning was written by Tented Hiker. When I was a young mother with two kids, about 8 months and 3, we lived in Pittsburgh in an old Victorian home, very common there. The kids were tired and needed to go to bed as we had to wake up early for work and daycare. When I returned to get my son to put him into bed, for some reason, I can't explain why, instead of taking him up the stairs, I just walked over and turned on the TV and asked him if he wanted to watch TV for a while with mommy. Peter Pan was playing that night, so he happily snuggled with me on the couch. My husband came in and asked me what in the world I was doing. Why had I turned on the TV when he needed to go to bed? I really couldn't explain my impulse, and I told him not to worry about it. As soon as he went by, my husband got more and more concerned about how late it was going to get with the TV on upstairs. The more upset he got, the more stubborn I became about not taking him upstairs. I knew this made no sense, as we both know he needed to go to sleep. We were usually very strict and rarely let the kids watch TV, so my husband had a right to be upset. I was behaving very uncharacteristically. But in spite of his pleading with me, I just wouldn't budge. It was baffling for me and my husband. Just as my husband started to get really frustrated with me, we heard a huge crash upstairs. We looked at each other and both ran up the stairs and saw what looked like a white cloud rolling on the top of the stairs. And something had happened in my baby's room, like her crib had collapsed or something large had fallen through her room. So we raced up the stairs and found she was fine, still asleep on the couch and undisturbed. But in my son's room, we saw the cloud of white dust still coming up out of the door. We looked up and saw that his entire plaster ceiling had collapsed. Only wood had fallen off of his bed. It was covered. One big piece was laying on his pillow where his head would have been.
Ooh.
So she just knew there was going to be a super that kid would have died if the ceiling crashed in on him.
Yeah.
Or she's a Taurus and she was just mad that he was trying to tell her what to do.
And then she willed the sky to fall because she's like, don't tell me.
You don't know the power of a mother.
Power of a mother.
You don't know the power of a stubborn person's fury.
Well, you know, that's what I'm saying, you know. So I've been trying to tell people, don't be stubborn. You're not. Well, you know, this lady was lucky that whatever feeling she had did turn out to be a good feeling.
I wanted to end it with that one because I felt like the other ones were so scary.
Yeah. The looped day was scary.
Terrifying. A lot.
Oh, and the we got him. That was pretty scary too. But yeah, so no, I forgot what I was going to say. We might have to loop around to this. So the one thing that I took from this story, okay? And I see it all the time.
Listen to women.
All right? Listen to your spouse.
Mm-hmm.
Every now and then, listen to your spouse. Every now and then, it's okay to break routine. You know, because there are things that will happen. There are different senses of something's going to happen. And sometimes people fight it. They're like, no, we got to stay on routine. It's like, no, you don't. Sometimes you can break it. Sometimes you can be like, yeah, keep the kids up. Who cares? They're the ones that have to deal with it tomorrow.
The daycare?
The kids will be the ones that are groggy tomorrow. Yeah. That's it. You know? So yeah, go ahead. Watch Peter Pan with them. Why not? Give them that moment, all right? Yeah. And then tomorrow we'll put him in a bed, in his broken bed.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, no.
Like, what is the anger about breaking routine? It's like, break it.
Maybe they're both Taurus.
Yeah, that's it.
All right, let's keep going.
So my topic is stories from India.
All right. The first story is called A Ritual Broken and a Deal Made, and is written by The Palmist.
This is a story told to me by my maternal uncle. In his second year of college, my uncle's interest in the occult became more real than he expected. Like with any interest, my uncle had found friends with the same level of interest. One day, his friends told him about rumored rituals being done in the Shamsan, I hope I'm saying that right, graveyard. Curious as to what happens there, he and his friends decided to pay a visit. They actually ended up meeting an occult practitioner there. Together, they started doing occult rituals on the funeral pyres that used to be burned in the graveyard. It turns out, the occult practitioner was also a beginner. They ended up making a lot of mistakes. As a result, strange things began happening to them. One of his friends contracted a high fever, with one of his friends becoming unexplainably sick. My uncle and his other group of friends decided not to tell anyone about what they were doing. They were equal parts embarrassed, regretful, and frightened. Meanwhile, his sick friend's parents took him to every doctor in town, but no matter what they did, the sick friend's health did not improve. My uncle began to feel more remorse than he could carry. In desperation, my uncle turned to a tantric, a master occult practitioner who had been visiting the town. My uncle had told the tantric about the day that his friend had fallen sick. It was after they had attempted one of the rituals. His friend was approached by a 16-year-old girl dressed in finery. His friend was so instantly smitten by the mysterious girl, he didn't even think to question what a young girl like her was doing in a graveyard in the dead of night. The girl asked for food that they had as an offering for the gods. His friend, as if in a trance, gave the girl the food. It was the following day that he had fallen sick. The tantric told my uncle that everything that was happening to his sick friend was because of all the mistakes they made. They had angered the spirits inside the graveyard. In order to fix it, they all have to come out clean about the rituals. The tantric decided to visit my friend's uncle. After assessing the situation, he called my uncle and explained to him what had happened. It turns out the girl was a spirit, obviously, but not just any old spirit. The girl was a Shamsana Dakini, the witch of the graveyard. A Dakini is a female demon or spirit in Hinduism or Buddhism. And depending on the context of tradition, a Dakini can be different levels of good or evil. In our region, Dakinis are thought to be the spirits of women who died during childbirth. When his friend had offered food to the girl, the spirit, he ended up offering her a part of his soul. The spirit latched onto his friend and began sucking the life force out of his astral body. This is what was causing the fever. Unfortunately, the tantric revealed to my uncle that saving his sick friend was impossible. By the rules of the graveyard, his friend had willingly offered a part of his soul to the Dakini. In return, the Dakini was free to do whatever she wanted with him. She would continue to slowly suck the life force out of him, after which his friend would become a spirit and a slave to the Dakini. Because of the amount of time that had passed from the day the friend fell ill, the spirit had already had most of his life force. If his friend were to be saved through rituals, his friend would remain paralyzed for the rest of his life. Also, the karmic repercussions of breaking the rules of the graveyard would be high. It was too late, and all hope was lost. The last time my uncle visited his friend was staring blankly at a wall. He coughed some blood and passed into the afterlife.
All right. This reminded me a little bit of the Japanese rock story that just happened. That was about a very similar thing.
Really?
But yeah, demon that got they trapped in a rock, and it was Buddhist monks that trapped in the rock.
Oh, and the thing just got split, right?
Yeah.
They said 1,000 years ago or thousands of years.
Yeah, that was actually the story I was going to do, but I just decided on heeded warnings instead.
Oh, no.
But the legend goes that there was a fox demon that had 9 tails. And it was, you know, doing fox demon stuff, trickeries. And a fortune teller had gotten the Buddhist monks to trap it in that rock for 1,000 years. And to touch it is death. And it's on an active volcano in Japan.
Yeah.
So it's been sitting there, like, don't touch this. It's got like, protection where you can go see it, but not touch it. And I guess it just cracked open. Shesho Siki.
Yeah.
Japan's Sesho Siki, the killing stone.
Yeah, I'd seen somebody mention
demonic
that.
Soul. Hell holds a demonic soul for 1,000 years is now becoming known to the general public. However, the story of the stone is bizarre.
Yeah.
Yeah, so hopefully the demon got out and he's going to reform.
Hopefully the demon, hopefully he got out and then he got onto Twitter. He's like, I like this.
Yeah, he got into some kind of...
Something else.
Yeah, hopefully he's doing something else. Hopefully
he's selling NFTs and he's like...
I was like, isn't that a Pokemon? Ninetales is a Pokemon and it's a fox.
Oh, man. Well, I'm sure
I forgot this part about the story. The fox turned into a beautiful woman and that's also how it would get his trickeries.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but again, Ninetales is a Pokemon. I wonder if it was based off that.
But it was like a beautiful woman with what? Nine beautiful eyes?
No, it was just like, it looked like a regular lady.
Oh, okay. All right.
But about your story.
Yes.
It did remind me of that. It seems like the Buddhist monks have a lot to do with more things than I thought and more demons than I thought.
Yeah.
I didn't know Buddhism had a ton of demons until now.
Well, I guess it's all about spirituality, and that's in there. That's in that mix.
Okay, let's keep going. A Final Ride, written by Harish Otu.
Lucknow, India, 16th of December, 2011, 5 p.m., a cold evening. I was visiting and staying at a hotel, and I was set to attend a dinner party that night. I called a cab company and booked a pickup at 7 p.m. 20 minutes later, I got a text with the cab registration number and the driver's name, Abdul Hassan. Exactly at 7 p.m., I got a call from the driver. Punctual, I thought. I went downstairs, checked Abdul's ID and the car number, and jumped into the front seat. He was a man in his late 50s, sporting a gray beard. He was wearing a traditional Indian dress, a white kurta and pajama. Abdul told me that, due to foggy weather, the drive would take a little longer than usual, maybe around an hour and a half. That didn't bother me because I only had to reach the party by 9 p.m. 10 minutes into the journey, I noticed that Abdul had not switched on the meter. I asked, "Mate, how are you going to charge me if not switched on the meter yet?" Abdul responded with a smile, "Never mind, sir, this trip is free for you." With a puzzled look, I said, "What?" Abdul clarified, "Sir, today is my last day on the job. I'm retiring tomorrow and will go on pilgrimage after that. This is my last assignment and you are my last passenger. I cannot take money from you." I shot back, "No, Abdul, I can't accept that. You give me service and I pay for that. We've only met 10 minutes back. I can't take any favors from you for no reason." Abdul said, "Sir, I always thought that I would do my last assignment for free. 200 rupees won't really make a difference to either of us, will it? Please allow this poor Indian man to feel good on his last day of work." Well, I could not argue any further. I just smiled and thought that simple good things that still have not vanished from this world entirely. Sometimes it's these poor people who remind us of these good things. I started chatting with Abdul. He had been driving for 35 years. Abdul claimed proudly, "Never once have I missed a pickup, sir. Never once have I not been on time." I could not disbelieve him. He had already won my heart. Then I noticed his watch, an old, worn-out watch that I could tell was not working. It was still showing 6:45 p.m. I found it funny that a man who was wearing a stopped watch was claiming to be so punctual. A bit sarcastically, I pointed out, "Your watch is dead, Abdul." Abdul said with a smile, "Oh, my father gave me this watch. It doesn't work, but it's my lucky charm, so I wear it all the time. But I don't really need a watch to be on time." We both laughed. Indeed, Abdul was on time, at least in my case, despite the watch. We continued to talk about various things, his family, my family, about the city. 90 minutes spent with a good man, and we reached my destination, 8:30 p.m. sharp. As I got down from the car, I said to Abdul, "You're a good man, Abdul. I know you won't take money from me, but just as a memory of this drive, I insist you take this watch of mine. Don't say no." I took my watch off and gave it to Abdul. Abdul resisted initially, but accepted my little gift finally. I thanked Abdul, and we said goodbye to each other. As Abdul drove off from his last ride, I walked into the dinner party. While I was still going through initial pleasantries with everyone at the party, my phone rang. The phone number was from the cab company. I thought, even though Abdul didn't want my money, I'm sure they did. I excused myself to take the call. A female representative said, "Sir, sorry for your scheduled driver's absence. We have another cab on its way to pick you up. We hope this delay hasn't caused any major inconvenience." Quickly, I replied, "What do you mean? I was picked up by your driver, sharp and on time. I'm currently at my destination." After a pause, the lady asked, "May I ask who picked you up?" I answered, although I was beginning to be perplexed myself, "Abdul Hassan, the driver who was supposed to pick me up. I even checked his ID and the car registration number before boarding." After another pause, the lady said, "Sir, are you sure it wasn't another driver who may have picked you up?" I started to describe the man who picked me up, assured that it was Abdul Hassan. I added, "I don't want to get him in trouble. If this is about the missing fare, I'll pay it. He said it was his last ride of the career," and the lady cut me off, "Sir, you must be confused. Somebody else may have picked you up. As Abdul was on his way to pick you up, he was involved in an accident and passed. We have just been informed about his death. It seemed to have happened 15 minutes prior to your pickup time." I froze and started sweating, even in the December cold. I thanked the lady for her phone call and just concluded that I may have been mistaken. As I went back into the party, I did a quick rundown of the entire ride. I was sure that I had spent the past hour and a half with Abdul Hassan. I hadn't realized yet all the strange coincidences of what he called his final ride. To try to catch any sense of normalcy, I looked at my wrist. My watch was still there. I don't think I'll ever be able to explain what happened that night.
All right. Imagine that you get to the afterlife and you still got one more thing to do. Like, you know what? I got one more delivery.
Yeah,
all right.
I need to do it. They need their Papa John's.
When me and Nick are gone, I'm sure there'll be one more story that we'll have to
tell. No.
Like, if there was one story we forgot to tell.
And they'll just pop on a notification. You guys ought to hear our weird voices.
Just laughing.
I kind of get it.
Like, that's Edie and Nick definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, bye guys. We're in the afterlife now.
Think about it. Like, if it was somebody who was like a Papa John's deliverer and then you still brought your pizza and you ate it, but you're like, "Man, I'm still hungry." And then they're like, "Hey, we're going to send your pizza." And they're like, "What did we eat? A ghost pizza."
The pepperoni.
The pepperonis.
All right, cool. Let's keep going. A Dangerous Dish, written by the Palmist.
During my childhood, I used to live in the city of Patna, Bihar. We used to live in a joint family. Back in 2006, my cousin's sister, Sadia, had relocated to Bangalore to attend her engineering college. Sadia was always cheerful, respectful, and courteous, so we couldn't ever imagine what was about to happen to her. One day, the doorbell rang, and I was the one to answer. When I opened the door, Sadia was standing there with a solemn look on her face. Our family ushered her in. They asked her about her trip home, a trip that was about 1,500 kilometers. Yet she had no recollection of the trip at all, not even how she got home. We later found out that she had taken a flight home. She claimed to have no idea. The next 6 months were painful to live through. Sadia started exhibiting signs of depression. She wouldn't talk to anyone, wouldn't eat properly. At times, she started burning up with fever and screaming for it to stop. At night, she would start laughing manically, yeah. And sometimes wail and tear her hair out. If someone tried to console her, she'd outpour a filthy barrage of abuses and gruff animal voice. My other sister is a psychiatrist. She promptly diagnosed Sadia with depression stemming from low self-esteem while in college and started a course of medicines. The medicines were administered to Sadia regularly for 6 months, but her condition did not improve. Some in the family felt there was something more sinister to Sadia's condition. My maternal aunt and uncle had reached a breaking point. They decided to seek the help of a master tantric. They'd just done about anything to get their daughter back. The tantric they reached out to was told to be extremely clairvoyant and adept at occult sciences. When he entered our home, Sadia began to scream and wail at the sight of him. The tantric just stared at her for a while. Then he told us that he'd be going home to perform the exorcism ritual. He instructed us to ensure that Sadia does not leave the house during that time. Exactly 3 hours later, Sadia again started her screaming. She tried to run out of the house. It took 4 to 5 males in the family to pin her down to her bed. She still tried jumping out the window. Her screaming alarmed the entire neighborhood, who gathered around the house to watch the spectacle. After about an hour, she fell completely silent. For 6 hours, Sadia slept like a baby. When she woke up, Sadia had turned completely normal. She calmly asked us what she was doing in her home and not the college hostel where she was supposed to be. She said she couldn't remember the last 6 months that had passed by. My maternal uncle and aunt went back to the tantric. They asked him what had happened to their daughter. The tantric nonchalantly replied that someone had put a lower class of jinn on her. The tantric said that the spirit was induced inside Sadia when she had eaten a tainted meal of biryani, a traditional Muslim rice dish. Whoever targeted Sadia had attached the spirit to a hair, which was then mixed in with the meal. The tantric revealed that he knew the identity of the person who did it, but wasn't allowed to reveal it to them. With the info provided, when my uncle got back home, he carefully asked Sadia about her last thing she remembered from college. Sadia's last memory was the day of Eid, which marks the end of Ramadan, a month-long fast for Muslims. Her Muslim friend, a man, had invited her for lunch and served her biryani. A few months prior, this friend had revealed his love for Sadia and even proposed to her. She politely refused his advances as she wasn't interested in him. The guy begged her to remain friends, which she did. Sadia couldn't recollect anything after eating that rice dish. My aunt refused to let Sadia go back to college after that. She continued her education at a local college. She later moved to the U.S. and is currently living a normal life, although the family avoids any mention of what happened to Sadia so as to not trigger any memories, both remembered and unknown.
All right, so somebody put a hex on Shania.
Yeah, Sadia, yes.
Oh, man, I was like, I really like that name. And then I messed it up.
Well, you're not allowed to name anything Sadia. Heated warning.
I like that name a lot. Okay, so somebody poisoned her with a demon.
With a djinn.
I've never heard of that before because I feel like you always have to accept them in. And if you're tricked into it, she was actually just tricked into it.
Yeah, she was tricked into it.
That's very rare. Well, remember the other story? The guy was like, I gave her food or I accepted food, whatever. And that was how the spirit attached to it.
Yeah.
But this was like she was tricked into doing it. She didn't do it willingly.
Well, maybe if you eat something.
I guess they're both tricked.
They were tricked. Maybe it's the whole thing like, do you want this meal? Yes. You know, and then now you're in it. You invited it in.
Yeah. That's another thing you got to worry about at parties.
Getting a demon.
You gotta cover your drink, because you never know.
And don't accept rice from strangers.
You never know who's gonna put a demon in your food. That's awful. Man,
that's terrible.
All right, we are on to our last story announcements. Don't forget to get on the Facebook group, the Instagram, and the website, All True Scary Stories with Edie, to send us your story. We'd love to read it and dissect it, live it ourselves, put ourselves in your position. Besides that, I think we'd have some shows coming up.
Yeah, I'm going to be in Dallas this weekend, Friday, Saturday, 4 shows. I'll be in El Paso next weekend, and then
Nick and I are going to be
in Laredo, Austin, and San Antonio in April 14th, 15th,
16th. Okay. If you live in any of those places, come out and say hi.
Yeah.
Besides that, don't you forget to give us 5 stars. Don't you forget.
Yes.
You keep forgetting.
And you remember us as the podcast that tells more stories
than
any podcast out there.
Yeah, somebody was like, these podcasts are better, and they only told 2 stories.
They only told 2 stories.
Yeah. So we went on their thing. We gave them 1 star because we were like, they only tell us 2 stories.
You know, and I think it was a gin that put that.
I'm just kidding. We didn't do that. I don't even know what the podcast was called.
It was called Two Story Town Tellers.
Nice. Okay. Nice. There you go. That got him.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah.
All right. This last story is called An Expired Match, and it's written by Pippinlicious.
Where my family comes from, arranged marriages are still very much the norm. It's not really what most people think, though. It's more like going on a blind date set up by people, usually your parents, who know you, love you, and have your best interests at heart, with a very clear end game. My parents always said that my opinion would be the only one that mattered in the end, that I could say no to whoever they brought home, no questions asked. A love match also wasn't entirely off the table, even if it wasn't their ideal choice for me. I watched my brother and 2 older sisters go through the process. In each case, they said Ma and Papa had done well for them. They all seemed genuinely happy. So the idea of an arranged marriage didn't frighten me, despite my Western upbringing. I was 22 when my Ma came home in a flurry, an anxious smile on her face. Pushing me towards the kitchen table, she said, "Amita, I need to tell you something. I have good news." I waited expectantly while she settled in her seat and grabbed my hands in hers. "I have found you a husband." My heart fluttered into my throat while I processed what she had said. I had known this day was coming. A year prior, my parents had made it known that they were seeking an eligible bachelor for me. But it still felt very sudden in that moment. When I didn't immediately respond, my Ma asked, "Aren't you happy?" Giving her hands a squeeze, I said, "Yeah, of course. Who is he? Do I know him?" "No. But you know Aunt Chanda and Uncle Raj?" I nodded. They were close friends of my parents from back in India. I'd only met them a few times when I was much younger, but I'd heard my parents speaking to them on the phone and knew they visited with them whenever they went back. "Well, they have a son about a year, about your age. Your papa and I have spoken to his parents. To him, everything seems perfect. He's smart, handsome, comes from a good family, and he's everything we could want for you." Her enthusiasm warmed my cheeks. The fluttering sank down in my stomach. "Does he have a name?" "Maru." She spent the whole evening telling me about him. He was a 26-year-old MIT grad with a degree in engineering. He loved travel and photography. She also told me what she remembered of him as a child. The more she spoke, the more I felt like he really could be a good husband for me. We shared similar life goals and expectations about what marriage would mean for us. By the time I saw his photo, which showed a handsome man with a slightly crooked but charming smile, I knew I'd speak to him. A few days later, Ma set up a supervised Skype meeting between us and our parents. When I saw him on the screen, flanked by his traditionally dressed parents, I found myself feeling shy and awkward. Our parents did most of the talking. He did ask me a few direct questions about myself. He even provided his own answers when I failed to ask him the same. Instead of being put off by my sudden tongue tightness, he was patient and warm. I was a giddy, blushing mess by the end. It was very unlike me, but it seemed to seal the deal in my parents' eyes. Once the call had ended, Papa said, "He's a good boy, Bitya. I think you'll be happy." Not wanting to get ahead of myself after one meeting, I conceded, "It's a good start." Papa patted my cheek and smiled knowingly. Things progressed quickly, which was exciting and scary and overwhelming. We had a few more supervised dates, then one secret call between just the two of us. It was on this call he said, "I want the decision to be yours, Amita, not your parents." Usually Maru was lighthearted and laid back, but now discussing our future, he was so serious, so intense. It made me like him more. I said, "It was my decision. It is my decision, and this is what I want." He added, "Then it's what I want too." We smiled at each other through the screen, both confident, assured, and perhaps just beginning to fall in love. It was the last time I saw Madhu before the wedding. He and his parents stopped the video chats, teasing that they were spoiling the bride too much. We communicated through emails and handwritten letters from that point on. Yet, after a few of these written convos, I couldn't help but notice that something had changed in the way Madhu spoke to me. There were times he was far more formal, and other times he was overly familiar. He was still sweet and still warm, but the ease with which we'd come to talk to one another seemed lacking. I mentioned it to Ma, who clicked her tongue and waved a finger at me. Men aren't so good with words, especially when it comes to putting their thoughts on paper. Your father is hopeless at expressing himself in writing. Don't worry. When he is here, you will see he is the same Maru that you have come to know. I hope she was right. A week before Maru's arrival, his mother, Auntie Chanda, flew in to help prepare for the wedding. We had important ceremonies and a huge party to plan. Hundreds of guests coming and only a little time left to prepare. Her extra hands were a blessing. I was surprised to find that she treated me so well. I had grown up hearing horror stories about mother-in-laws, but it appeared that I had lucked out. With only days to go until the wedding, Auntie Chanda invited me to sit with her while she looked at a photo album of Maru's life. She said, "He was such a sweet boy." I saw tears forming in her eyes. "He's always taken such good care of me and his papa." I got up to grab a box of tissues and set them in front of her. "Mataji, are you okay?" "Yes, yes." She hid her face in a tissue and laughed in embarrassment. It's just hard for a mother to say goodbye to her son. We looked at the pages and pages of Maru growing up, all the way to a recent picture of him on a motorbike with a helmet tucked under his arm. At seeing his smile for the first time in over 2 weeks, I felt that familiar flutter start up again. "You will be a good wife to him, won't you?" She grabbed my hand and squeezed it so tightly that I cried out in shock and pain. She released me immediately but repeated the question with the same urgency. "Yes," I said. She started to sob into the photo album. I excused myself pretty quickly after that and ran to my room, unsure of what exactly just happened. The morning of my wedding arrived. My female relatives flooded the house. From the time I got up, I was passed around like a dress-up doll for mehndi and hair and makeup. Once I had my red and gold sari on and was allowed to look in the mirror, I almost burst into tears. I'd never felt so beautiful before. There were strange whispers between the family present here and there. I only noticed because each time I would come into the room, they would stop talking completely and avert their eyes. When I couldn't take it anymore, I dragged my mother into her bedroom and shut the door. "What's going on, Ma? Why is everybody acting weird?" Ma busied herself in front of the mirror, touched up her lipstick. "I'm not sure. It's just people talking. Don't worry about it." "Don't worry about what?" Ma said. "The car's here. We need to go." My frustration flared, but I wrote it off as heightened emotions. Usually, I would have been accompanied by numerous bridesmaids. Usually, the parking lot outside the temple would have been overflowing. Usually, there would have been a swarm of people milling about, shouting blessings and greetings. But I was alone in my limo, except for my sisters. When we arrived, there were only a few cars, and no one was outside. The balloons and flowers stuck out bright against the all-too-quiet and still backdrop. I asked my sisters, do you guys know what's going on?" They looked away and didn't answer. My father met us outside the temple and took me by my hand. "Papa, please, what's going on? Where is everyone?" He said, "Later, later." He led me inside with heavy but steadfast steps. The temple had an odd smell, a choking combination of overly sweet and pungent, the cloud of incense and perfumes that had been used to burn my eyes. The further we walked in, the thicker it became. Eventually, I could feel it coating the back of my throat and inside my nose. The lights were dimmed, so much so that the sacred fire over which Maru and I would hold our hands burned brightest of all. The temple was almost empty. Where was my family? Where was his family? The music and laughter and joy. There wasn't even a priest. This didn't feel like I was walking in my wedding. Maru was seated with his back to me and made no move to rise. His parents stood off to one side, watching me with anxious, nervous expressions and wringing their hands. My mothers and sisters were hanging back behind me. I could feel their eyes on me, burning into my back. Nothing about this felt right. We're almost on Mahu's side. Papa's fingers tightened on my arm. I glanced at him, but he wouldn't meet my eyes. The smell was so strong I started to become lightheaded and swayed dangerously. I tried to breathe only through my mouth, but it did nothing to lessen the awful stench. I could taste it. Beside me, Papa was starting to dry heave, and it made me do the same. And Maru just sat there. I pulled away from Papa. Despite his protest, I closed the distance to my future husband. Maru had been very handsome the last time I'd seen him. Now, he was barely recognizable. His eyes were bulging and milky in their sockets, ready to pop. His skin, green and white and stretched taut where it was still attached, had sloughed off in chunks, leaving him with barely half a face. There was no slightly crooked grin, only yellow teeth and cracked and swollen lips. He was pregnant with all of the gases and decay of death. The smell that they had tried so hard to cover was coming from him. I reeled back, my hands over my mouth. I looked at my parents in horror. Uncle Raj was the first to speak, and he spoke sadly. There was an accident a few weeks ago. A truck hit him while he was riding his motorbike. It's so important to be wed. I'm sorry. Cutting her husband off, Auntie Chanda said shakily, "You made a promise to be a good wife. You will fulfill your duty to my son." I shouted, "Are you crazy? He's dead." Chanda's voice was getting higher and more frantic. "You would let him travel through this life and next with no one to care for him?" I whirled on my parents. "How could you agree to this?" Ma replied quietly, "We didn't know until this morning." Papa tried to say, "It's only symbolic, for your auntie and uncle's sake." Chanda said, "You can't let him go into the next life alone. You were meant to be together. He needs his wife." I said, "He needs to be cremated." Ma said, "Chanda, this was a bad idea. We shouldn't have allowed it." Chanda was beyond hearing, though. She charged across the room and grabbed me by my hair with a vicious shake. "He will not be alone." She yanked hard, pulling me towards the metal vessel where the sacred fire burned. I screamed. The others were frozen in place, horrified and stunned. I struggled against her surprisingly strong grip. She shouted again, "He will not be alone." I could feel the heat pulsating off the flames. She was trying to push my face into them, trying to burn me so that I would either be too disfigured to ever marry again or join Madhu in our next lives. The end of my hair sizzled and singed. My family finally snapped out of their shock and sprang upon Auntie. They pulled at me, at her, tried to get her to release me. All the while, she screamed that Madhu and I were meant to be. It had all been perfect. I couldn't abandon him now. In the scuffle, someone knocked into the vessel that was holding the fire. It teetered, unnoticed by most, and then fell. And all it took was a single hungry spark. Thank God the temple wasn't filled with people, although maybe the fire could have been stopped by someone. I think we're all too traumatized from what was happening to be the hero for the building. When all was said and done, the temple had burned down, and Madhu with it. Auntie Chanda wailed with more than a grief of losing a child. She truly believed that Madhu would be alone in the afterlife forever. At some point in history, there was such a Hindu practice called sati, an act where the widow would join her deceased husband on his funeral pyre to be cremated together. Sati was officially outlawed in 1987. Well, thankfully, my family didn't require me to be that traditional, and I think I'll be the only one in the family to not have an arranged marriage.
All these mother-in-laws are crazy.
Crazy.
Wow, that was quite a story.
Yeah.
I'm glad that her family didn't go with the tradition and have her join him in the next life. Very sad that he had passed away. So did the grandmother not tell them that he had passed away? Not told the parents?
Auntie Chanda didn't tell them until...
Her parents. Not only she didn't know, her parents didn't know either.
Her parents didn't know until the morning. And they were just like, it's symbolic. Let's
so he can have someone in heaven.
Yeah.
But then the other practice is like, no, they need someone in heaven right now, so you're out of here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, luckily they didn't do that, but that's what the mother-in-law wanted. Mother-in-law is just obviously really grief-stricken.
Yeah.
And doesn't want her son to be alone or scared on the other side.
It was her little prince.
She probably feels a little bit weird about it now, where she was like, "Oh."
Yeah, I mean, it would be weird. They still hung out and they're like,
yeah,
play Scrabble
that.
Or whatever.
Sorry about
and every word was fire.
Like, oh, what's no. your fire?
Oh, no.
I already did fire. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening to True Scary Stories with Edie and Nick. We love you guys. And we hope you stay safe. Sorry about the little lack in episode. Nick was on a cruise for 2 weeks. And, man, it was rough. There's been a lot going on in the world. It's been very, very, very hectic time. So we hope you guys are all staying safe out there, still washing your hands, and just staying out of trouble. We worry. I worry.
Yeah, I worry
a lot.
I think you guys are cool.
All right. Love you guys. We'll see you on the Facebook group. Bye.